I was raised sort of staunchly an atheist, or as I've come to realize now, science worshipping. Secondary school, we did slave trade every year. Not realizing that that's not how you get best served as an adult in the modern world, except now they are. We see advocacy groups scream and scream and scream. It's one of the things I said to my father within the first few weeks of being there. I rung him up and I said, I don't understand what's going on. He says, what do you mean? I'm like, everyone here's a moron. It shocked me that the whole world is looking to the big universities, Oxford, Cambridge, Yale, Harvard, believing that this is the home of the smartest people in the world. I didn't see the point of performing womanhood. Yeah, I'm not sure whether I'm able to have children now because I took puberty blockers for 4.5 years.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, as you know, I am very interested in what is going on in the world of Generation Z, because it seems to me to be, in many ways, the first sort of parentalized generation, the first generation in which they are somehow being told that they can sort of think for themselves and they can create who they are and that they're right and the parents are wrong and that we should just obey, they should be obeyed by their mum and dad rather than the other way around. I find this fascinating. So with me, I have a very good example of Generation Z, and that is the journalist Charlie Bentley Astor. Charlie, hello.
Hello.
It's good to see you again. Now, can you tell me, I should tell viewers that Charlie and I were having a bit of a chinwag before the old interview. So how do you think about it? I mean, I said to you before the interview that when I was, I'm 18 years younger than you, and when I was young, I was rather reassured by the fact that we were ruled by a generation who had fought and won a war. That was what they'd been in, and they fought and won a war, and you felt a sense of everything's going to be all right. That's how I felt. So how is it then if you're born in 1998? What's their feeling towards the people that are running the country?
Chaotic. That they need leading rather than are the leaders. I think it's evident from their need to amend their behavior chronically according to public opinion that they don't have any clear vision themselves. And so this kind of uprootedness is contributing to the sense of instability that my generation feel, I think, and sort of both economically and philosophically and spiritually. That there's no leadership. When you've got the Archbishop of Canterbury who will celebrate Diwali, or priests of the vicars of the Church of England saying that, oh, we're all Muslims at heart. You think, no, you've forgotten your principles somewhere. And the lack of principles is causing great turmoil, I think, in Generation Z.
So the idea, you go back to the 80s, in Parliament, there were substantially there were a lot of people that aren't there. There were gentry who'd, and there were people that had been down mines. And as a gentry, if they've run a farm, that sort of thing. Do you think this is germane to a feeling of stability we might have had, which you don't, that they've had to sort of do something? What do you think about that?
Obviously, it's competency, isn't it? When you have generations, when parliament was more hereditary, you had a proven succession of family behind a person who's had to, you know, generation after generation, father after father, teach his family how to manage an estate, which had normally a village or two attached to it, how to support those villagers, how to ensure that they have work, to feed them. And that involved managing your accounts properly. Often in times of war, it was the landed gentry who were the military leaders. Even in the First World War, it was the upper class who were generally the generals. in these situations. And if you come from working stock, coal miners, farmers, you are very up close and personal in a way that actually the upper class were previously, with the consequences of not working efficiently, not working hard, not pushing through challenges. You know, if you have a mine collapse, you don't just go, oh, well, I guess we'll just jack this in. You have to clear out the rubble, sometimes pick out the dead bodies, figure out what you did wrong and keep going. And so, like with the landed gentry, if you have a bad year, you can't just go, oh, well, I'm just going to go and buy my food elsewhere. You've got a revolt on your hands if you don't, you know, help them store the grain properly and it rots. And so I think this burden of responsibility upon the very lowest and the very highest classes in this country had a level of sanity and groundedness in tangible reality of the consequences of actions, which I think politicians have become detached from.
So a lot of people these days that are in the government, this is Lord Carrington, and he was foreign secretary when I was born, and he was an hereditary peer. He was a soldier, of course, and then a landowner and hereditary. Now, a lot of people these days would think it was absolutely appalling, the idea that somebody should have a position in government by hereditary right, essentially, and not because they've been elected. But do you feel that actually there's something to be said for the hereditary principle in Parliament?
Something's been lost. It doesn't help if the people arriving at Parliament today were simply people who came from a strong family background, who have a specialist skill, be it in managing a company, being in the military, even being a teacher, having a profession, and having a heritage and a level of responsibility in their local community, giving them that skill set, we wouldn't have the problems we have now. But the only way we've managed to secure that in the past is the hereditary peers. But now, obviously, with Labour is proposing we completely scrap them, that could be the final death knell, I think, in uprooting us.
Okay, now so we have this change that's occurred then since the 80s, and how would you say it impacts, if you think about your parents and them being at the or me at the fag end of the sort of Christian society, as it were, as opposed to someone born in the late 90s, where what we now call woke is definitely in the ascendant. So how is being at school how is it different? I mean, how weird would I find it if I went back to school now in England? Because I can't really, living in Finland, I can't really conceive of it. You were saying you don't learn history properly for a start, which
I went to a state mixed sex state comprehensive. It was quite underperforming when I left in 2017. The school had a banner outside saying 48% of our students pass English and maths. I went, okay, so that means more than half fail GCSE English and maths. We, even in my primary school years, we might have sung hymns but not church hymns, more just like communal songs that sometimes mention God, and that we had no prayers because it was exclusionary to people of other faiths that we didn't have in the school, because my town was basically completely white, British, and we weren't taught history in that. Throughout primary school, we did a bit of the Tudors, and I did a bit of Victorian England for 1 year, and that was it. And then in secondary school,
didn't do the Battle of Hastings.
No, and I live near there, right? And we didn't even go to a school trip there. So the fact that that's on the doorstep and we didn't go there is probably an indictment upon the education we're getting. But in Secondary school, we did slave trade every year. Every year, we didn't do either of the world wars. And then I did A level, and then I did the Tudors again, looking at it more from a geopolitical point of view, and then I did America between 1945 and 1989, I think. All we looked at was the civil rights again. We didn't even cover the Vietnam War, which is obviously a huge part of that piece of history.
Horrific.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you mind me asking, were you christened?
No.
This is nothing. Sorry.
I know you, and it's normal for my parents' generation and everyone beforehand, even if you weren't a practicing Christian, it was a rite of passage to be baptized, and I wasn't. And I think most people in my school hadn't been. I was raised sort of staunchly an atheist, or as I've come to realize now, science worshipping. Science had come to replace God in my upbringing. And so I was almost coached to look upon those with any kind of faith with derision and mockery because, oh, they believe in the big God in the sky rather than the cold, hard facts presented to us by the science trademark.
I mean, even your name, as we were discussing earlier, is essentially gender neutral, isn't it? I mean, it's Charlie.
Yeah, it's not Charlotte, it's Charlie, which confuses a lot of people.
With an I and an E, which is in the masculine way. And that was deliberate?
Yeah, I mean, my dad, I think there's a perfume called Charlie, which he says there was a new one the month I was born, so I was named after that. But my parents cycled through feminine names. I think Emily was one of the names they were thinking of, but they liked the neutrality of Charlie as a name.
So they were then holding to the, as it were, the de rigueur way of thinking, which was slightly less popular in the late 90s.
Yeah, it wasn't gender nonconformity back then or gender neutrality, but what it was is a product of the sort of third wave feminist equality movement, which was finally sort of coming to the pinnacle in the late 90s, early 2000s, where men and women are completely the same mentally and physically. There's nothing a woman can't do that a man can't do and vice versa. Other than giving birth, but obviously now even that's up for debate. And so, I mean, my mother's quite masculine temperamented. My father's lived and worked with women all his life. So he's sort of seen not just the aestheticized version of womanhood, but womanhood in all its glory and brutality. And so was more flexible in his idea of what a daughter might be. So as a product of that, my parents raised me in the they let me do what I want, basically.
Right.
Played with trucks rather than dolls, played in mud, joined Boy Scouts, wore trousers and dungarees, and if a dress was put on me, I'd rip it off. So and that was all okay.
Did your grandparents or whatever find this strange?
So I think sex stereotypes, as in the nurturing maternal side, the prettiness that's associated with, you know, little girls, because most little girls do enjoy that, was introduced into the mix by my grandparents and my parents' friends. You know, they'd buy me pretty things or dolls or sort of girly things to do with my hair. And they wouldn't hold much interest for me that those elements were there, but they never, whilst they might say to my parents, oh, are you sure that, you know, don't you want to make sure that she gets in with the girls, you know, they wouldn't force it. And so I suppose I was quite self-led in my pursuits and the way in which I construed my role in my family and in my friendships and school life.
Did they? One thing that we tend to do as a society is we pass down information, oral tradition, and it gives us a relationship with our ancestors that we've always done the same things. There are various, that's why church is interesting, various rituals that you go through that the ancestors have gone through. With your generation, a lot of them, that is seemingly cut off.
non-existent. Yeah.
Were you told nursery rhymes?
Not really.
Right, you're the second person of Generation Z that said that to me.
Okay, interesting. Okay, I knew a couple. I'm not sure how I learned them. I think it might have been at a sort of church nursery group that my mum went to, just because all the women in the town were going to it. It was a relatively small town at the time, and so I might have got taught a couple there, like Ring a Ring of Roses, but it wasn't a part of it was a part of my school education. Like, I didn't in nursery get taught these things, or in early primary school.
When your parents put you to bed when you were a child and you were young, and they read you a bedtime story?
For a period of time, I think. Not classical stories. My dad tended to make them up. I had a toy dog called Rusty, and he went on lots of adventures, but I didn't get read the sort of classic stories of George and the Dragon and things like that. I couldn't even list the sort of stories I might get taught.
Right, so this is a break with the past, then. This is a fundamental break with the past. You are, I suggest, the first generation not to have gone through this. Mm. I assume that when you were badly behaved, there was some nonsense called the naughty stir.
Oh, not in my house, but in certainly all my other friends. In fact, my other friends almost never got in trouble. I had one friend who comes from, the father's from a Christian family and the mother is from a like proper gypsy family. And so he had a naughty step, and the mother was absolutely uncompromising. And if he didn't stay there, occasionally he got a whack. But if I went to like my friends' houses and they were chatting back to their parents or whatever else, the parents just sort of stand there and try and look stern and threaten to take away, you know, toys or something, but they'd never follow through. And so the child was definitely in charge.
So right, now that's interesting. So this idea of the child in charge, let's move on. Let's talk about that. Child in charge. So from a psychological perspective, it's extremely damaging for a child to be in charge. It's known as parentalization. The child is not used to it. The child can't cope with it. And it does two things. It creates mental instability, essentially, in the child, or it contributes to it, because it's anxious. It's, no one's there to look after it. And also a kind of narcissism, i.e. that it gets whatever it wants. And so therefore later...
Well, it becomes the centre of the world, right? They become the centre of the world because there is no one telling them no. There is no external world which their world is butting up against. Now, obviously, psychologically speaking, three-year-olds are very selfish because they are completely unaware of other people, what it's like to embody another experience. But once they outgrow that, they're supposed to come up against other worlds and reassess what is permissible and what is not, what is acceptable, what is not, what is good and what is bad by encountering other worlds and other people. But if everyone around them, particularly the adults, kowtow to that, to their world, they never encounter resistance. And so, of course, they're going to think that what they feel and what they believe to be right in a moment, normally it's just whatever instinctually they want, you know. I want to play more with this. No, I don't want to have a bath. All of this kind of stuff becomes the utmost authority in their life is the feelings they have in the moment.
So in a sense, there's no authority beyond them. In a sense, they're almost like God.
Yes, except the feelings. And if they can't replicate the feelings in that moment because they can't run the bath themselves, they have to wait until mum does it, or they want to eat the food but they can't have it right this second because mum needs to prepare it, they're going to throw a hissy fit about it. And so at that point, the thing they're beholden upon is not themselves but the feelings that are holding them hostage, which I think is why you see a lot of sort of woke 17-year-olds literally throwing themselves on the ground and screaming, because they're in charge until something prevents the feeling from being satisfied in that moment, and then the feeling completely takes over.
So this is the interesting contradiction in the research on sort of narcissistic personality, that it partly is expressed as people that are highly neurotic and mentally unstable and whatever and have negative feelings, and so then they create this narcissistic false self that they're perfect and wonderful. Mm-hmm. And the worst thing is then for them to be confronted with something that indicates they're not, and that they, and then they have cognitive dissonance and they have to make this go away. And the way they make it go away is to make the person that's confronting them with whatever it is that's part of their identity, which makes them perfect, is wrong, is just screaming at them and shouting at them and whatever until they...
Taught that that works, right? They've been taught that that works, because when the parent said no, they'd scream and scream and scream and scream until the parent gave in. And so they'd not been socialized out of that behavior, not realizing that that's not how you get best served as an adult in the modern world, except now they are. We see advocacy groups scream and scream and scream about something until they get what they want, whether it's good for society or other populations or not.
And they can't believe it when they're very rarely, I think it's just people on the left, frankly, they're very rarely stood up to. And when they are stood up to, then they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do. What do I do? Do I scream more? In general, people will back down. People will back down to apologize, in order to calm down the situation, because that's what mentally stable people want to do. They want to calm down the situation and not escalate it. And so when people, it's very rare when they escalate it, and I quite enjoy escalating it. Then you get very interesting responses from them. I was just no. It's like dealing with my cat upstairs when he meows for food. No. And then eventually he sort of backs down. It's quite interesting.
People can't understand that your personal agency, my personal agency, holds the same weight in reality as their own. And so they can't understand why people are unyielding to their demands, because again, they're the center of all reality.
So they are that. With reference to the comparison I made earlier to God, which you nuanced and said, "Oh, but the thing is that they have the feelings." Mm. In a sense that they are not the God of the New Testament who is perfect. They are the God of the Old Testament who comes across as rather insecure. Mm. He gets very upset when people don't worship him enough, and he lashes out and sends down plagues on Job, and it's like Allah needing to be worshipped five times a day.
A vengeful God,
a childlike God, who a capricious, angry God, who's deeply insecure if he's not worshipped by those he has created, and that's more what we're looking at, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, and it's because there is no external authority by which they temper their own perception of reality. Now, obviously, in previous times, that's been God and the Christian God, at least in the West, and the judgments and constraints of that God is passed down into the parents, which is then passed down into the children. And at some point, we decided that that was tyranny. I don't know. It's the elevation of freedom is the highest ideal. I mean, I still think freedom is, but it's freedom within a boundary that creates something interesting. Freedom without it is chaos.
It's like the difference between postmodern sort of literature and traditional literary forms. If you give someone certain restrictions, you must write poems like this, then they're forced to be creative within the restrictions. If you give them no restrictions, then it can just be their own just mind vomit nonsense.
And the thing is, if art, for example, or political policy is not created in relation to something else, you cannot divine meaning from it. So I love modernist literature in the way that it reacts against Victorian literature. Stylistically, it's very different. But the only reason I can appreciate what it's doing and understand what it's attempting to capture is by viewing it in relation to the past literature. If that past literature didn't exist, it would be utterly inane, you know, mess on a page, which is why I hate my background is in the study of literature and arts and drama. And the reason I hate the postmodern literature in relation to art is that they think the mere sort of vomiting of emotion is expression, but they don't realize that expression has shape. And so we see, you know, the taking of modern art that's like the urinal, and it's just like, I don't know what I meant to intuit from that. It doesn't.
It's meant to be the sort of ballsiness of challenging all traditional forms. So rather than trying to capture some kind of perennial experience in a new and unusual and interesting way, it's just trying to basically be clever. That's from what I can work out.
But the thing is, right, I saw this piece of art recently at the Tate Modern. It's in the corner of one of the galleries, and everyone was just walking past it. No one was standing contemplating it. No one was photographing it. Compare that to the queue of people to take photos of the sunflowers at the National Gallery just down the river. It speaks for itself.
I suppose you get some bits of art that are, as it were, postmodern, new neurotic realist, whatever. That are sufficiently interesting that you will stop and look at them. So if I go back to, well, it was the year you were born, Sensation at the Royal Academy. And you had the Jake and Dinos Chapman, and they did these mannequins of children with like anuses as mouths and weird things like that. There was another one where this guy called Chris Offaly had done an image of the Virgin Mary, but he painted it using elephant dung. Or there was another one where they'd got Myra Hindley, the child murderer, painted using the hands of children.
Wow.
Now these are shocking and whatever, but they are at least visually interesting.
And they are being defined in relation to something. And there is a more right interpretation to that work. So like the dramatic example, the example from theatre from that same period is Sarah Kane. She takes Brecht's epic theatre and puts it on steroids, and people struggle to stage it just because it is dramaturgically difficult, but also literally vomit inducing. The last time they staged her big trilogy at the National Theatre, people literally threw up and passed out watching it. But
I can say that in, I think it was about 2001, I managed to sit through Blasted out vomiting. I was absolutely fine. I sat through Phaedra's Love without vomiting. I've sat through every play of hers, actually. But as I used to be, when I was about 18 or 19, I was very, very interested in Sarah Kane.
Yeah.
I used to write my own plays. I had one at Edinburgh, inspired by Sarah Kane. Mental woman, hanged herself at 28 with her own.
Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy, crazy.
Fundamentalist Christian background, strictures, structure, order, response against order, violence, interesting stuff. But going back then to these kids with whom you were at school and at university, how do you feel that in light of what we've discussed so far, this peculiar upbringing, peculiar in historical terms, manifests? Can you give some examples?
The feeling that they don't have to deliver essays on time is a huge one. Almost no one is delivering their essays upon time. Now, everyone, you know, you get the flu, you get too drunk and hungover. The point was, is before, you know, if you were too drunk and hungover, you sat there bloody miserable at your desk pushing that essay out, regardless of how it would turn out. And from that experience, you learned a lesson. Don't get hammered before you have to write a big final essay. Now you just apply for an extension saying, oh, I'm having a rough time, mental health day, blah, blah, blah. And the teachers say, oh, no problem. Just get it to me when you can. That's the phrase. And so this happens every single week for many, like pretty much all students, I imagine. And but there's never any consequence to routinely delivering essays late. Because it's so normal.
When I was at my university, we had to write one essay a week. I get the impression that a lot of universities one essay a term, and they can't even deliver that.
We had to do two a week, and then in third year it was sometimes three a week, and we were writing our dissertations on the site. So it is a high pressure situation, but. You'd still see that, and I know at other universities where it's sometimes like 2-1 a term and people can't. It's not enough of it, yeah.
Okay, now one of the issues that you've discussed elsewhere is this idea of gender dysphoria and people identifying what gender they are. So I wonder to what extent being brought up in this self-absorbed way in which one is not being directed, as I like to put it, on the adaptive roadmap of life, one is not being instilled with traditional gender roles, one is not being told, no, you can't do this, no, this is wrong, here's your border, don't cross it, no, imbricates this issue of sudden onset gender dysphoria and all of this sort of thing. Could you tell me about that?
You know, I actually think it's the assertion of gender roles, at least in the rapid onset gender dysphoria seen in teenage girls, that is the problem, because it's the hyper feminine, over sexualized, sort of pornographic female, which these young girls feel that they have to mimic. And if they don't like that idea of almost, you know, very violent sexual interactions, that they have to not be a woman in order to escape experiencing that. And I think young men will say sometimes really recount very violent sexual fantasies, sometimes as a result of exposure to porn, not realizing that that's not real, that it is just a fantasy. But the problem there is that girls don't realize that's not actually the standard anyone's expecting them to live up to, and that by calling yourself a boy means that it doesn't mean you get to opt out of that. And I think the distress that so many people, girls who are identifying as trans, comes from the fact that no matter how much they transition, they still get that sexual attention. I've seen plenty of people on TikTok complaining about the fact that they now get fetishized for their trans status. And so I think it's actually the hyper feminine stereotype that's causing girls to try and opt out.
Right. So, and what is it that? So, is it partly that they're allowed as children to be tomboys and not directed away from that? Is it partly that it gives them a kind of social status in a left wing society? What do you think are the underlying causes to this?
I mean, there's definitely a status element to it now, but what you'll see is the people who are just craving the status and attention will say that they're non-binary or that they're bisexual, because you don't actually have to justify that with material action. You can say you're a bisexual and never have a sexual encounter with the same sex, or you can say that you're gender non-conforming or gender neutral simply by not wearing a dress as a girl and having your hair like a little bit edgy short. I talk to primary school teachers who are like 25%, 30%, 50% of their class are saying that they're something else or saying that they're animals. And I mean, there's an interesting psychological underpinning to this. So 3-year-olds, 3.5-year-olds can't imagine what it's like to be somebody else. It's a stage in their neurological development. They can't understand why when they snatch a toy off of another child, they'll get upset. They can't imagine what it's like. But the way they move out of that stage in their psychological development is by playing pretend. They'll pretend to be a shopkeeper. They'll pretend to be mummy. They'll pretend to be daddy. And it's not that they're literally mimicking mum and dad. They're trying to identify the essence of mum and dad. So they'll pick out the maternal role of mum and the physical activity of dad and mimic that. And so the shopkeeper, they're not imitating one particular shopkeeper they've seen. They've watched many shopkeepers as they go about the world and are imitating, trying to identify the essence of that. And so I think this kind of explorative play has been clamped down upon.
Did you even have clapping games at school?
What?
Well, you know, like girls used to sit there, like girls would be at the playground, infants would be like, when Susie was a baby, she would be, and she'd say, wah, 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 and they're identifying.
No, not so much. I think there was a couple examples when I was maybe like nursery, very early primary school. But no, the boys and girls.
If Susie was a teenager, she'd be, and she'd say, miss, I lost my bra. I left it in my boyfriend's car, like this. Susie was a mummy. She'd be actually smack, like this. Granny was knit. So they're identifying the essence, you see, as you say.
Yes, exactly. And I think that explorative play has been clamped down upon because adults are too encouraging of it. When a kid goes, I'm a cat, they actually don't believe that they're a cat, but they're trying to embody that role as much as possible until the parent says no, or to a parent says, that's enough now, we're done with that game. And in which case they've taken what they can learn from that and then they move on to the next thing. And so the things that really interest kids, you know, say like they're thinking about being a doctor or a vet or whatever it is, they might return to that character again and again and again, because they're trying to really suss out the depth and complexity of that role. And that's where our interest in later life sort of develop. But what we're seeing now is when kids go, I'm a cat, the parent goes, yes, you are.
Mm-hmm.
And the game never ends. And I think sometimes kids are perhaps worried about ending the game, that they're going to upset the parent by going, actually, no, I don't think I am a cat anymore. Or, you know, I don't like being a cat anymore. And we see it with the gender role. So it's really quite common that boys will put on their mother's makeup or heels, and girls will put on their dad's, you know, jumpers and big boots.
Mm.
Rather than seeing that as an attempt to understand the opposite sex, which they then integrate and then move on, it's being reinforced as a...
My daughter used to tend to shave with my razor.
Mm.
She was about 3.
Yeah.
That's a very piquant way of putting it there, Charlie. A game that never ends. And I wonder if that's a degree to, if you're a generation where, in a sense, life hasn't been real, there's been no suffering, nobody's wanted for food. I mean, go back to I don't remember it as a kid born in 1980, but if you go back to people born in 1960, there were some kids that were so poor they couldn't afford pants. And because PE was done in your vest and pants, they were therefore didn't have to do PE because they didn't have pants. So that's how far we've moved in not very 60 years. Life is a game that never ends. In terms, there's no serious.
Well, material scarcity has not put constraints upon their play. And to an extent, actually, you kind of need that absence of material wealth to play properly. If you've got too much around you reinforcing the game, it begins to blur the distinction between game and reality. If you're a very poor kid and all you've got for your knight in shining armor is a broomstick that you hop about on and a twig. You know,
You don't have to be creative. You don't have to be as creative either. So like when I was a kid, I liked history a lot. And I liked, for example, Tudor times and Anglo-Saxon times when I was 10. And my Lego would reflect this. But there were only three kinds of Lego, the big three: Danish town, space Lego, medieval Lego. Oh, and later pirate Lego. But you can create Anglo-Saxon Lego or Tudor Lego by combining elements of these.
And you'd even maybe cut out paper and, you know, try and manufacture the things you needed.
But now they've just got it all. They don't have to be creative. They could just get what they want.
But there is no distinction between the imaginative world and the physical world. And so that then presents a problem with an issue like trans, because you don't see why the material world cannot reflect that which you imagine. And I think that's why these games have endured and why people are beginning to get distressed now, this generation, as they reach adulthood, because there are constraints being placed upon their ability to play, like the necessity of having a job and earning money and interacting with other people who aren't necessarily going to negotiate your ideas.
And they extend, I mean, it's arrested development in the sense that they push out the idea of being middle-aged, right? Oh. I'm middle-aged, and I have no problem admitting that. But it strikes me that I'm 44, and I was middle-aged, surely, by any reasonable definition of life, I was middle-aged in my early 30s. But there's this idea now, oh, you're not middle-aged till you're about 40, if not older.
Well, and that's because realistically, you know, when my parents were born, they were expected to live to 65, 75, and their parents were expected to live to 60, 63. But now people can almost guarantee living to 85. So middle age has, in a biological sense, shifted into your mid-40s, but your role in society hasn't necessarily migrated with it. People aren't becoming parents until later now, which is then shifting when you're a granny.
When I was at ARC where we met, I was aware of a chap who was in his early 30s and was contemplating moving back in with his parents to save money because it's so expensive to live in London.
That's an abhorrent thing to a young person. It's the thing you do when you completely lost your job and you need, you know, like 3 or 4 weeks to find another and find another place to live. You know, it's the thing you do as a last resort. People go to extreme lengths to avoid doing that, you know, but young people are very comfortable with doing that now. And I think it's this extension of perpetual childhood.
Yes, that's what it implied to me, perpetual childhood. Right.
I never have any time. I'm extremely disorganized. Things basically overwhelm me. I don't know why this is. It's probably some sort of genetic thing. I'm basically present-oriented, a fast life history strategist. I really should find out more. And in order to do so, I should probably read this book, Blueprint, by Robert Plomin. It's a fantastic book, and it looks at the genetics of our psychology, the genetic reasons why we have the kind of personalities we have, why we have the kind of intelligence we have. Maybe that would help me make sense of why I'm like I am. I should read that book. But the problem is, as we've established, I never have any time. So I don't really see how I can read it. Or so I thought, until I discovered Legion.com. What Legion.com does is it takes the most basic and interesting books, including Blueprint by Robert Plomin, and it summarises them into just 25 minutes, and then it allows you to listen to those books. That's my problem solved. Legion.com. And if you sign up today with the code TJH, then you will get 10% off. Legion.com, all the base knowledge from your phone straight into your brains.
So with regard to the trans issue, which we discussed, and the pressures that girls feel under, obviously you've become, you've very bravely gone public about your own experiences with this. And so could you tell me a little bit about, excuse my ignorance, but sort of how does it feel? You're what? 10, 9 years old, how does this process start, that you start feeling discombobulated about being a girl, or what is it that happens?
And it is still something I'm trying to unpick all these years on, because you're embedded within so many philosophical frameworks that emerge out of the liberal progressive tradition that you have to understand what endures beyond the framework. And all I've been able to identify is an extreme revulsion towards things that were feminine, like pregnancy, motherhood, being the center of sexual attention. And I thought the only way to get away from that, one, I didn't understand that there is a lot of scope within those responsibilities and roles within society, that actually a mother is not just, oh, you know, with the doll. It's you know, long nights. It's creating stuff for your kids. It's you know, so many different things. And likewise, I thought that I had to surrender all my intellectual pursuits. Now, I am masculine temperamented in a psychological sense. I'm low in agreeableness, that's to say high in disagreeableness. I'm quite assertive. These traits that, you know, and I'm talking like lower percentile, so I'm quite like distinctly outside the traditional feminine range. And so ideas are far more important to me than people, which is generally the characteristic temperamentally between men and women, is that women's attention and their interest is orientated around people, and for men it's things and action, and I'm one of those people. So I was devastated at the idea of having to surrender my intellectual pursuits in order to become a mother, and so I wanted to escape that at all costs. And so the way I thought I would do that is by becoming a male, and I didn't have a clear sense early on of what that meant, other than I wasn't going to wear the dresses, I was going to cut my hair short, I was going to go get a man's job. You know, I thought about going into the military or becoming an engineer, and that's in part because I admired my dad more than my mum. My sister admired my mum more than my dad, but he was in the military. He has done sort of physical labor jobs his whole life, but he's also, you know, relatively smart. He was an electrical engineer in the military. And so I my role models in life were all masculine. And so I thought, well, if I just do what they do, that kind of makes me a man. I really didn't have a clear sense of roles and why the roles existed. For me, they were very arbitrary. I didn't see the point of performing womanhood, performing being a mother. I didn't understand that actually that holds a deep spiritual weight and evolutionary purpose. It was just a meaningless act to me, and that meaning is integral to both understanding and accepting the sexes that we're born with. And so I had a poverty of that, and that made the prospect of puberty extremely daunting, to the extent that I didn't find it.
Why, from the way that you talk about yourself, certain sort of autistic traits, high male brain, you know, southern man
spectrum.
Yes. So it was also the change, just the fact of the change of puberty.
Absolutely. I was repulsed by my body. I felt betrayed by it, because up until that point, I'd been the tallest in my primary school class. I'd been the fastest, beating many of the boys whom I played with instead of the girls. And then suddenly, for literally no reason to my mind, nature had thwarted me. The boys became quicker than me, stronger than me. And I became the worst at many of the activities that I had excelled at only a year beforehand. And that's how quickly, you know, those changes take place, is that within the space of like a year in primary school, maybe.
Hadn't your parents prepared you for the fact that this was going to happen?
No, we didn't talk about it. It was all very mysterious. You know, you get told by my parents' friends who also had children who I was at school with, you know, you're going to grow up and get married and have a job and have babies, and then you get old and die. That's such a broad sketch that I couldn't visualize it enough. So then it became a very scary, the absence of information became intimidating. And I think part of the problem is that we don't have intergenerational households or communities anymore. So I had grandparents, but they weren't in my life a lot because they didn't live nearby. And so my whole house, my whole street was full of young families. And so I only ever encountered kids who were approximately my age and their parents, who were all in their sort of like mid-30s to mid-40s at the time. In previous generations, not only did you sometimes have multiple generations living in the house, you had the grandparents in the house or living next door or across the road. Obviously, everyone's now spread out geographically much more than they were before. But the way in which people came together in community settings like church, like village dances, like the harvest, you would see the generations laid out before you from a very early age, and you could get a reasonable idea of what your role meant within society in a sex-based term, because you'd see the full spectrum of womanhood there. You know, the women go out, you know, picking the rocks out of the fields and carrying the goods, but they also give birth to the children and make them clothes and all this kind of thing. And you see the men tilling the ground, tending the horses, providing for the women. And you'd see the whole generation there on these harvest days at these village dances, and you could get an idea of who you would become across the spectrum of your life. You would see your older siblings who were, you know, helping raise you. You know, you saw the age you were going to be in a couple of years in the siblings above you.
You had, in a sense, then you had structure and order.
Yeah, exactly. And I was going to say you had expectation, but
expectations.
What is the product of structure and order? Clear expectations. And so I think young people in general lacking that ability to visualize who they're going to be, and that not be an intimidating thing, that every era of one's life is meaningful and has its own roles and responsibilities.
The idea that we be whoever you want to be the best version of yourself, be true to yourself, is in some ways rather intimidating.
It implies a fixed self, right? And the psychology, the philosophy around the experience of self, what enables us to identify with our 5-year-old self, and when we're, you know, in our later age, still see that as the same self, but simultaneously also develop as a person, is still relatively unclear to us. It's something to do with memory. It's the closest we can get, but certainly that this idea of an integral self, I think, was less, both more and less apparent to the generations before us. And I think the more apparency comes from their understanding of themselves within a heritage and a country and a historic framework, and less apparent because they had to subvert their own personal needs, desires, and aspirations for the greater good of their family and their wider community.
Yes, group oriented. Right. I know this is now turned on its head. It's more apparent in the sense that they are an individual spark of divine light in a world of darkness that must create themselves. But it's less apparent in the sense that they're not even christened and don't even get fucking nursery rhymes with it.
Yeah, they don't know what to create out of the freedom that they have.
Okay, so it seems to me that the consequence of this this vacuum, almost, of structure and order and expectation is a parentalization of the child. Is it that the child, as we discussed earlier with furries and whatever, the child is put in charge, And it seems to me that rather tragically, that is the situation to some extent anyway, with you and people like you, with regard to gender dysphoria. And so then you've made effort.
It's a difficult one, because if someone had just insisted to me at the time, no, there's no getting out of the fact that you're female, you're just going to have to like it and lump it, it really wouldn't have helped at the time, because there was no one fleshing out for me why I was finding that so distressing. If someone had just, I mean, if someone had sort of, you know, backhanded me much earlier on and sort of explained it, I wouldn't have found it so difficult to have that reinforced later on. I understand the genuine anguish that people get, and the, you know, when you see them literally throwing themselves on the floor over this stuff, when they're challenged, it does make it worse. But simultaneously,
what if they just said, "Look, Charlie, darling, shut your mouth and put your dress on, or I'll belt you on."
Wouldn't work.
So it was the fact that there was the possibility there, and then you were telling me earlier that consequently you took puberty blockers. Which have, as you said, a lifelong impact.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether I'm able to have children now, because I took puberty blockers for 4.5 years, and my body's not producing my sex-based hormones naturally. I have to take them, and so sort of waiting to see whether my sex organs and my brain begin to produce that again.
Are you open with any gentleman friends you might have about this problem?
I've kind of taken it off the table for now. Simply having gentleman friends, as you put it. It is partly because I'm still fundamentally an ideas orientated person and a bit autistic in my fixations, and so prioritize reading books and going and having philosophical debates over going on dates. But obviously if I get round to having relationships with people again, it's going to be the crux of the problem, because the kind of man that I want and admire is the man who wants to be in that masculine role. It wants to be the provider, wants to be the father, wants to have the children. That's the kind of man I want to be with. And obviously I would, as a woman, want to provide that for him. I want to create that home, have those children, and have that family in the deepest sense of that word. But I don't know whether I can do that.
How do you feel about that? That this is what potentially you're infertile at 26, in prime of your childbearing years. Well, a bit after. How 22 is optimal.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this?
I mean, I was very shocked initially, because I'd been told that this, I'd been assured that this wasn't going to happen, and then when it did, and the shock wore off, it was grief, because, you know, you immediately get people around you saying, "Oh, well, you can adopt," and all of this kind of stuff, surrogacy, blah blah blah. But no one, particularly if you have a as I do now, a very deeply developed sense of your historical place and of lineage and of generation and intergenerational striving, knowing that your family have successfully reproduced for thousands of years and you are the end of the line if you don't, it feels like you're letting down your entire family lineage. So who have battled in wars, if you're my family.
50% child mortality.
Everything, you know, who sacrificed their whole lives to make sure that their children could grow up in a better position that they could and have their own children. And to not do that I still haven't probed the depths of how that makes me feel, because it's such an intimidating thought. But that's what girls are being robbed of at the moment.
And I would argue that you have been badly treated. Society has let you down by pushing you in a maladaptive rather than adaptive direction. Do you feel a sense of something external to blame, or do you blame yourself?
I mean, I got this. It's something I haven't even thought about. I blame myself, and blaming other people is something I hadn't really even occurred to me. So when I went on Andrew Gold's podcast and I saw all the comments underneath saying, oh, it's just a typical another trans person blaming everyone else but themselves, I've only ever blamed myself. And I think I always will, because I'm one of those people who think I'm fundamentally responsible for everything I do, even at a very young age. But certainly the environment in which I was raised was not conducive to me adapting to coming out with the best possible circumstances. Now, obviously, historically, that's more been material, not having the best start, you know, being undernourished or lacking food or dying of a disease before you reach adulthood. Those were the ways in which you were thwarted. But now it seems to be much more on the psychological front, now that material scarcity is not such an issue.
Yeah, woke eugenics, as I said before. Now, one of the things that you've done was quite interesting.
Are you ready for the future of the West?